Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And something that people might not realize, that is roses are indigenous to Iran. And distilling the essential oils of the flower to make rose water has been practiced there for over 2,500 years. Every May, when the city of Kashan is enveloped in pink and a sweet floral scent, there's a festival that honors the ancient tradition of boiling petals in barrels of water and collecting and condensing the rising steam. Hence, we get from which we get rose water. Now, rose water, as many of you know, is, in this country, primarily was used in baking. But we will hear some of its other uses and some of the background, because I have with me today cookbook author Yasmin Khan. She recently attended one of these festivals and notes that for Iranians, the rose transcends botanical or culinary significance. Yasmin was born in London and lived in Iran as a small child, and has traveled back and forth many times to the country. And she has a recent book called The Saffron Tales, a wonderful book with delicious recipes, and through this book, it opens a window into the country and its cuisine. Before immersing herself in the Persian kitchen and Persian food, Yasmin worked as a human rights campaigner working on issues of social justice and poverty, with a special focus on conflict in the Middle East. She's a regular contributor to British television, and her written work on recipes and food has appeared in many publications throughout England. Welcome, Yasmin.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
I love what the publisher wrote about your book, that in The Saffron Tales, Yasmin Khan reveals a side of Iran that never makes the headlines, but is central in its story. It is its dazzlingly delicious food. And I think that's a wonderful thing to say about, you know, we forget so often about everything else that goes on, and got to step back and say, well, what about the people? What about, you know, what about their lives and their food? And indeed, in this book, you really do it.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, as someone who was born in England but has family and deep roots in Iran, I've always been very aware of this massive gulf that exists between the Iran that I know and love and how it's routinely kind of depicted. So this book, for me, was very much about trying to take people on a journey through the country and be able to showcase some of the beauty and art and culture and history that exists there.
Yeah. Well, the Rosewater Festival, which actually is going on right now. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. It goes on for the harvest is for the next month.
That was a wonderful revelation to me. I didn't realize that roses were indigenous to Iran. Are there festivals in places other than Kashan? I know Kashan is the Mecca for roses, and in fact, there's a story about the Mecca being cleaned with rose water as well, right? Is that the the main place? Are there other festivities that go on around the country?
Well, you know, over the duration of the Rose Harvest, which starts now and goes on for the next kind of 6 weeks, there are all the towns in which kind of roses are collected will have large gatherings. But Kashan's the main hub for the kind of annual festival, which gets, I mean, it gets thousands of visitors every year.
Oh, I can
flock
imagine.
There.
It's just well, gorgeous. It's beautiful too. I mean, you look at that many roses mm-hmm. gathered in one spot. That's great.
And as you drive in to the kind of town, you just kind of, you know, I remember like it's warm, you know, it's spring at this time of year, and you just get hit with this waft of roses, just the sweet scent. So it's just quite extraordinary just to see kind of the different stages of the process. You know, it's such a delicate process. You know, the roses are harvested by hand, and then, you know, the petals individually removed, and then they're placed in these large steel vats and filled with water and boiled. And then the water that evaporates and comes up from the... not evaporates, obviously. The water that boils comes up and is extracted, and that is distilled to make rose water. And then, you know, depending on the intensity of the distillation, it can also be condensed into make kind of oils.
Well, and I read somewhere where the oils, you know, obviously the rose water production is a big deal because everyone uses rose water throughout mm-hmm. the country and abroad. But the rose oil... amazing. I mean, you don't get a lot of oil from all that distillation process. You get mostly the condensation mm-hmm. of the steam for the rose water. So very little is produced, and the price of a bottle, something between $7,000 and $10,000 for a small bottle of rose oil, I read. And of course, one of the major purchasers is France and their perfume.
Wow. Yeah.
Business.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, when you know, the most of the time when we kind of go and buy rose essential oils here, you know, it will be heavily blended.
Of course. Yeah.
So when you get the pure extraction, you just need a tiny drop. And
oh, I can only imagine. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Well, so rose water is an integral ingredient in a lot of the cooking, not only cooking, but other traditions throughout the country. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Well, it was fascinating that you kind of raised the Mecca issue. Roses are used in a variety of ways in Iranian cooking. Obviously in desserts, you know, flower waters such as orange blossom water are also used. I can go through kind of the foodie things in a minute, but other ways in which they're used are medicinally. So, you know, different natural herbalists in Iran will kind of offer you remedies for ailments such as stomach ache or headache. Obviously they're used for beautifying kind of products. You know, my sister uses it as a toner. It's very common to kind of use, you know, rose water. It's supposed to be very good for the skin, anti-inflammatory, and obviously the scent is exquisite. But for religious reasons as well, when people pass away, actually, they will bathe the body in rose water before you bury them. The idea being that kind of helping people on the journey to the afterlife, that they're bathed in this kind of beautiful water. And also in Mecca, the cleaning that will happen. And they will kind of
use the rose water, the purest of water, right? From the history of American cooking and baking, it was a while before we had vanilla beans, and we were able to import vanilla beans and had vanilla extract. So rose water was something that was available, and rose water was the flavoring. You mentioned for sweets and for baking. Indeed, rose water, orange blossom water, as you mentioned.
Yeah. And one of my favorite recipes that's in my book is a recipe for a Persian love cake, which is something kind of I invented. That's a kind of celebration of the Persian garden, really. And it's an almond cake that's flavored with rose water and then topped with kind of a lemon zest and rose petals and pistachios. But roses, I think rose water is such a wonderful addition to desserts, and you just need a tiny amount, and that floral scent that you get is exquisite.
I was doing some research on the Rose Water Festival just to learn a little bit about it and sort of have an idea of what we would be talking about. And I was amazed. And the process, I know they have a mechanized mechanized processes, factories for, you know, because it's such a huge production that goes on with supplying rosewater all over the world. But they still use some of the old stone ovens, stone fireplaces, and fired by wood and clay pots. And
that's it's a very laborious process. So you can kind of understand why it becomes such a an expensive ingredient. But in a way, I think, you know, that adds to, you know, there's something very romantic about roses and rose water.
Right, right.
They're very evocative, aren't they? You know, the colors, the scent. You know, I think there's a reason why throughout throughout millennia, they've been used in so many different cultures as a romantic kind of tool.
Yeah, and I think, an expression, just the flower itself is a beautiful expression.
It is. And I think that is part of the magic of that festival for me, kind of when I visited it, because you feel a bit of that magic through the different, you know, centuries and thousands of years old processes that you see. You feel as if it's very enchanting.
How many bags of rose petals does it take to make a one bottle of rose water? I mean, you know, so many.
I was thinking, I was like, do I have an answer for that? I don't, but many.
I mean, just I looked at pictures of that were just, you know, fields filled with, you know, harvested roses.
Yeah, amazing. And beautiful pinks and fuchsias and reds. There's this particular flower called the Ghul-e Mohammadi, which is the one that is used predominantly to make rose water.
Right.
And that's the one where the petals are also used decoratively. You can often find them in Middle Eastern shops. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous
And
pink.
We know them, I have that, we know them as the damask. Roses.
That's right.
Yeah. I knew I wrote that down someplace.
Yeah. Right. And actually, there's a place in where in Europe is very famous for the Damascus rose. I want to say Bulgaria. That's the author, which is also something I found out in the research, you know, as I was doing research for kind of roses. That's the other central hub for this particular type of rose.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in how plants travel and how ingredients travel. So I wonder which way.
Well, ingredients in particular in the Persian kitchen, there are so many aromatic ingredients and ingredients with very intense flavors. And what comes to mind immediately, are pomegranates, dates, barberries, nuts, herbs, lots of herbs, orange blossom water, as you mentioned, and saffron, of course. The title of your book is Saffron Water. Tell me a little bit about the Persian pantry. What are staple items like that are important?
Well, what I think is so exciting about the Persian kitchen is that the flavors that you find there are very welcoming. You know, it's not an overpowering cuisine. It's not an assault on the senses in the way that Thai or Indian food is. I think, in a way, rosewater is a perfect example of a Persian flavoring because it is subtle and sweet and delicate. And you'll find that in all of the ingredients in the Persian pantry. Saffron being, obviously, the title of the book, but also probably the most evocative of Iran's spices. I was lucky enough to visit, in terms of harvesting, a saffron farm during my journey for the book, during the saffron harvest. And again, it was just fascinating to find out why this is such an expensive ingredient. You know, saffron can only be harvested for around 3 weeks a year in late October, early November. The saffron comes from a purple crocus, and the crocuses can only be picked at dawn. That's when they open up.
Yeah.
And they each have three stamens. So again, you know, I was visiting this farm and thinking, gosh, this is such a, you know, can only be harvested by hand and such a laborious process, but so much kind of love goes into it and that kind of,
I mean, I dole those threads out very, very carefully when I use them, because I realize, well, first of all, it's very expensive, and you see why it's expensive. Mm-hmm. It's labor intensive. But those three little stamen, I mean, they're not even a half an inch long, it's just, tiny little things that have to be very handled very delicately.
Yeah,
amazing.
Which is why in Iran that we prepare them in a very unique way, and that I've not found any other culture that does it. But it's the way to get the most bang for your buck with your saffron. In that we always grind saffron stamens with a pinch of sugar or salt, and then steep them in hot water, so you get this kind of red scarlet elixir that you can just drop into your dishes,
right,
and it makes a very it enables you to get the most potency from the stamens. Mm. So here we have saffron. Other common things you'll find in the Persian pantry are molasses and kind of fruits that were used to flavor dishes. The dominant flavor of Persian food is sweet and sour. It's that kind of Italian agrodolce flavor, and we use pomegranate molasses, date molasses, you know, dried plums, dried apricots, barberries, kind of lots of sour fruits to temper our stews and soups and rice dishes. So that's a very common part. And I would say then, yeah, you hit the nail on the head actually when you mentioned the herbs. I think the other defining feature of Iranian cuisine is just the copious amount of aromatic greens that we put in our dishes.
I was thinking of like a cuckoo in a little frittata or omelet made with... didn't even know eggs were in it because it's all green. It's all herbs. It's wonderful.
You just look at it and it feels like it's good for you. It's this kind of verdant celebration of spring that we always eat at Iranian New Year, which takes place on the spring equinox.
Right. Well, your food writing is both, as you've mentioned, both very cultural and very personal, having roots in the country. And you stated that many of the recipes in your book are for dishes that have been cooked the same way for thousands of years. And surely you modernized a few of them for the book, I mean, because of methods and things. But talk a little bit about some of those dishes that are the traditional dishes that have been cooked that way. I mean, I know there are many of them, but the ones in particular that stand out for you.
Sure. Well, I guess the standout dish would be a dish called fesenjun, which is chicken poached in a sauce of ground walnuts and pomegranate molasses. Walnuts are used in Persian cooking in the same way that, say, peanuts or groundnuts are used in East Asian cuisine. Like, we use them in all kinds of stews. We grind them into pastes. And this stew is one of my absolute favorites. My grandmother used to make it with duck. You can also make it with eggplant. And it's creamy and sweet and sour and just incredibly simple. And, you know, there are records in Persepolis, which is this ancient town that's ancient ruins that are over 2,500 years old, kind of one of the old centers of the Persian Empire. But they're on some of the stones that you find there, there are references to fesenjun that they've kind of found in that the old emperors would be kind of given this stew. So, I mean, that is an example of a dish that's extremely old. And, you know, it's a dish that only has a couple of ingredients in it. So it's stood the test of time because it's so delicious. So that's an example of a classic dish. But, you know, what I wanted to do was very much make Persian food accessible. And part of that means modernizing it. I think that up until this point, actually in the UK, we've seen a real surge in interest in Middle Eastern and Persian food. But I think one of the reasons it's yet to have broken out of its little niche is a lot of the recipe books that kind of came out from the diaspora many years ago were very much focused on kind of chronicling kind of age-old recipes. But I really wanted to make recipes that we could just cook, you know, on a midweek day kind of supper that just brings some Persian elements into it. And also because of the way I like to cook and eat, kind of there's a much more of a focus on kind of vegetable-based dishes, plant-based dishes, adapting recipes to make them quicker to cook, less fat, less meat. So some examples of that would be another kind of one of my show-stuffing dishes, actually, I think, in the book. It's a baked rice dish. Now, cooking rice in Iran is elevated.
Persian rice is very special.
Yeah. And so this is a dish that's normally made. It's kind of layers of saffron and yogurt-infused rice that you put a layer, and then you would traditionally put a layer of chicken, but I kind of use eggplant and mushrooms, cooked with cumin and... cilantro seeds, and then I put another layer on. So that's kind of example of kind of making something vegetarian. How else have I adapted? I've adapted so many of them, actually. Let's think. Another one would be some of the soups that I make in the book. Again, kind of Iranians are big soup makers. The word in Farsi for cook is oshpaz, which means soup maker, and the word for kitchen is oshpazi, which means place where soup is made. So a lot of the soups I've kind of modernized to, again, kind of reduce the meat content, flush up the vegetables and just make them quicker to make.
Interesting. And it's something that could be stretched
for
many days and for many people, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. I notice that you don't have a lot on breads, even though breads are very important in throughout the culture and the food. But I will say that you can't leaf through this book without getting hungry. The pictures are beautiful, but the recipes, you're right, they're very approachable. For me in particular, some things you don't even realize, you'd be eating them and not realize that they're necessarily Iranian, Persian,
mm-hmm.
and we'll talk about that too, cuisine. I'm thinking particularly of like a cinnamon and date omelet.
Oh, my God.
I mean,
so
you know,
good.
Just it's what a nice, sweet, you know, like a delicately sweet breakfast treat, you know, and yet it's just and fragrant with the cinnamon.
It's one of my favorite recipes in the book. It's so easy to make.
And another one that was the first recipe I kind of keyed into because I was leafing through and I stuck on that page was it's rice with lentils
mm-hmm.
and dates mm-hmm. and walnuts. And I mean, this it's just a rice dish, right? Mm-hmm. And lentils, but yet it has this richness to it.
Mm-hmm. I think, well, that there's a big misnomer about Middle Eastern cuisine that somehow it's very alien or complicated or difficult. I think just those recipes that you outlined just now just show that actually often it's just about using ingredients we'd have in our pantry anyway, but in a different with a different technique.
Maybe not 4 cups of walnuts, but
no, exactly.
But you're right; a lot of walnuts are used in that. And I know I had Naomi DeGood on with her book, A Taste of Persia, when she traveled throughout the country looking and had to cook some of the recipes for an event. And I said, more walnuts? More walnuts? I mean, there were so many walnuts used. Walnuts and herbs. I mean, I could have bought the store out.
You know,
But what a delicious combination.
Yeah, and I think one of the really exciting things that I discovered on my travels through Iran was just the diversity of the cuisine. So, you know, I traveled 2,000 miles from the north of the country by the mountains of Tabriz, where the food there is very influenced by kind of Turkish cuisine and Georgian cuisine and uses like judicious amounts of dairy produce and thick slabs of cream with everything. Through the rice paddies by the Caspian Sea, where my family are from, where it's all kind of lush, green, verdant landscapes and tea plantations and rice paddies. Through the deserts of the Persian of central Iran, where they use lots of dried fruits and dried nuts, right down to the south of Iran, where the food is just completely different because the south of Iran used to be on the old maritime spice route, bringing mm-hmm. spices from India to Venice. So the food there is a mix, it's like a thrilling mix of Indian and Arabic flavors. So the main thing I discovered, and I've tried to chronicle in the travel essays in the book and also the recipes, is that, you know, Persian food is so diverse and it's such a huge country that each region that you visit, because of the climate, because of the landscape, it just has completely different recipes. So, you know, bread being a perfect example, my family are from the north of Iran, where my family are rice farmers. So I kind of had the luxury of having this playground as a child of a farm to run around on with my grandparents. But, you know, we traditionally, I mean, my grandfather could easily eat rice kind of for breakfast, lunch and dinner, you know. I mean, he wouldn't, but it's depending on where you are, the food there is different.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, there, and you mentioned your grandfather and you mentioned some spices, which are a couple topics I'm going to touch on when we come back from a short break. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls. But here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Yasmin Khan, whose book is saffron tails. Let's get it right. The saffron tails from Bloomsbury Press. And one thing that I wanted to talk about, because I know so many people are often confused when you say, well, Persian cooking or Iranian cooking. Well, Iran is in what was Persia. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, actually, Iran has always been Iran to Iranians. Persia was just the name given to it by the ancient Greeks, and that kind of stuck in the West for thousands of years. In the same way that, you know, lots of countries, you know, Germany, people in Germany call their country Deutschland. In India, it's Bharat. So that's very common.
Well, the Roman Empire is the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
it has a little far-reaching, a little further reaching.
So what happened was around in the kind of mid-1930s, the Iranian government kind of issued a decree that kind of requested that actually everybody in the world call Iran by the country, by the name that it's always known itself. But, you know, what happened really after the 1979 revolution in Iran, because Iran became so associated with its government and with kind of negative connotations that surrounded that, a lot of people in the USA started referring, who are Iranian, started referring themselves as Persian. Hmm. So it's a very American phenomenon that in Europe we, used to calling it Iran, and in the US just because of so that's the thing. So I really battled over whether I should do that, because in a way, you know, you think of Persia and you think of like magic carpets and Shirazada and 1001 Nights, and you think of Iran and, you know, on a good day, you know, people think of bombs and nukes and angry mobs. And, you know, I actually you know, the whole reason I wrote this book was that I wanted to kind of get past those stereotypes. And the reason I traveled around Iran and into people's homes and sharing stories from inside Iran was to try and capture some of the beauty that exists in this place, and kind of get beyond the stereotypes and share something that everyone can relate to.
Well, when you mentioned, and I'm glad that you brought up the travels, because I was going to ask you, what do you mean by the land of milk and honey, you know, going to Tabriz? But, and then you cleared that up, because Georgia and that whole region up there, as you said, is known for their cheeses and dairy. And so aside from there being different regional differences in the cuisine, which makes all sense, you know, all the sense in the world, it also crosses other borders. It crosses borders of what now are independent countries and religions. And yet all the food is pretty much, they're eating the same ancient foods, right?
That's right. What do you mean? Sorry, I did.
Well, just, I mean, that all these foods are all part of, you know, you can eat dishes today that were eaten, you know, by other cultures, you know, so many years ago, and people might have their differences, but they're all eating basically some of the same foods.
Yeah, there's a rich tapestry of commonality that threads its way through Iranian cuisine.
When you were reproducing some of these recipes, and obviously you did a lot of your work in London, I would imagine, right, when you came back. Ingredients that were harder for you to find, spices in particular, and what spices are really truly different that we might not be that familiar with?
I don't think there are that many. I think Persian food is really accessible. In terms of saffron, obviously we use that in our rice dishes. And the other main spices we use are cumin and cinnamon and ground coriander seed, but cilantro seed. So as long as you have those in your pantry, you'll be able to whip up a Persian feast.
Now, I ran into a little problem in reproducing some recipes with trying to find...
Gulper.
Well,
that's
that one. Yeah. And fenugreek. Fenugreek leaves. I mean, I can find the seeds or the powder. Or powder was difficult to find.
Yeah, so fenugreek leaf is... I did write it in London. And in the UK, we have such a massive Indian population.
So you find it, yeah.
Yeah, so we find it there. So it's often labeled methi
how I ended up finding it. I went to an Indian supplier of spices and found methi. So I don't have that, but I have frozen leaves of methi.
Yeah, But again, like I said, you know, it's interesting in terms of food trends, because now in the major supermarkets in the UK, so Waitrose, Sainsbury's, etc., I mean, they all sell barberries and pomegranate molasses, right, and saffron. So hopefully that will kind of expand here in the US, yeah, as well.
Well, we can now finally easily get yes, pomegranate molasses. That's, yeah, for a while it was difficult, but now it's much more accessible.
Right. Great.
Well, I want to touch on, you mentioned the what do you call it, a love cake or a sweetheart, mm-hmm, cake, but some other sweet, that's my new go-to for Valentine's Day now. Yeah, forget the chocolate. Some other sweets, because I know we think of the date of so many dates and dried fruits being used in the more savory, as you said, the sweet and sour dishes. What in particular were some of the sweet dishes that you presented in your book?
So, seeing as we're celebrating rose water, I'll talk about those ones first. So, there's a big influence of French pastries throughout Iran. Iran, and there was a big crossover between Iran and France in the last kind of century. My grandfather learned French at school in Iran. And that means that on every street corner in the country, you find little patisseries selling small pastries. And one of the most common ones is nanekhami'i. So, they're little shoe buns filled with thick slabs of rose water. Water cream and pistachios, so they're kind of crunchy and creamy. So I've got a recipe for that in the book. Again, you know, shoe buns are surprisingly easy. People stay away from shoe pastry, but
it's very easy,
you know, and very fun to make. So that's one. Another one on the celebrating kind of rose water aspect is a dessert called Ferni, which in the book I kind of suggest you can make with orange blossom water as well, but I personally prefer it with rose water. And it's a Persian twist on a rice pudding, really, though instead of using kind of rice grains, you use ground rice. So you can buy that in a store, or you can just shove your rice in a food processor till you get a fine powder, and what you end up with is this very creamy set pudding that has a consistency somewhat of a panna cotta, that's flavoured with kind of, you can use the milk of your choice, and rose water and cinnamon and date syrup. But what I also wanted to do in the book was to celebrate Persian ingredients in the desserts, because in the Middle East there isn't a massive dessert culture in the same way that we're used to. And, you know, being from the UK, I mean, we're very fond of tea and cake. So I had to put a few recipes in there that, you know, such as my like sour cherry and pomegranate sponge cake, which is kind of a real fusion between the classic Victoria sponge that is very common in the UK. But, you know, sour cherries are just such a quintessential kind of flavoring in Iranian food. Right, so, right. Yeah, using that.
Well, between that and your rice dishes, it's fabulous. One thing that you mentioned when in speaking about the Rosewater Festival, the fragrance of the roses and the flavor that lingered in your mouth, and you named a dish in particular. You had been eating rosewater sorbet with vermicelli. All right, tell me about that.
Yeah. Oh, so this is quite a special thing, actually. So, the town of Shiraz is known, it's in central Iran, and it's known as the epicenter of Iranian poetry. So the ancient Sufi mystical poets such as Hafez were born there, and his tomb is there, and Iranians flock to this. It's like a pilgrimage, you know. And so it's set in a beautiful garden. And, you know, in Iranian poetry, roses play a very, references to roses are just dotted throughout Iranian poetry. Kind of the rose and the nightingale are kind of symbols of like the love, like two lovers and kind of the role play between them. And that's all supposed to be kind of a representative of the your relationship with God or relationship with yourself. So it's very kind of mystical. And so we went and visited this sacred spot of poetry. And it was very fitting that the main dessert from that region, from Shiraz, is this beautiful sorbet that's made just with rose water, lemon juice, and obviously water. And it's got frozen, very thin, rice vermicelli in it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you douse it. You can add like a dollop of sour cherry jam onto it, or I just liked it with a squeeze of lime. And it was just exquisite. I remember sitting in this garden, kind of eating spoonfuls of this iced dessert on this beautifully hot day, surrounded by kind of pilgrims and also flowers. And it was quite magical, really.
Oh, yeah, well, it just brings to mind all those vats of beautiful roses, too. I mean, just that is, it's something I'm sure to behold. And one of those things on my bucket list, you know, I'll try that. Well, Yasmin, thank you so much for joining me and sharing all this information about the Rosewater Festival and the cuisine of Persia. And again, the book is beautiful from cover to recipes to, you know, the photographs within. And it's called The Saffron Tales, Yasmin Khan, by Bloomsbury Press. Thanks so much for joining, and thanks for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.